Cutting the noise, mapping the moves, explaining what matters and what does not. Welcome to The War Room with Dr. David Katz, your weekly briefing on military strategy and the conflict shaping our world.
You are listening to The War Room on 101.9 High FM with David Katz. In the last 72 hours, events in the Middle East have escalated dramatically. I was scheduled to talk about the way forward for Gaza, but these cataclysmic events over the last few days have overtaken the narrative. Israel, in coordination with the United States, has launched a deeply planned and highly synchronized air campaign against Iran. Early reporting suggests Israeli strikes focused on elements of Iran's senior command structure, while American forces concentrated on degrading radar networks, missile infrastructure, and key military assets. Both elements have registered early successes with the decapitation of the regime and a degrading of the military. This marks the first fully integrated, large-scale operational strike conducted jointly by Israel and the United States against Iranian territory. The logistical complexity alone, long-range strike packages, aerial refueling, maritime coordination, electronic warfare, airspace, deconfliction suggests weeks and months of intense preparation for this operation. The implications are absolutely profound. What are we witnessing? A limited operation aimed at degrading military capability and restoring deterrence, or something more ambitious, such as a fully fledged attempt at regime change? Although these events are seminal for the future of the region, most of what is going on operationally is pure conjecture at the moment. So after looking at what we know about the current events, I want to relate it back to the long-term prospects of Gaza. To help unpack both the current battlefield and the strategic horizon, I'm joined this evening by Dr. Jacob Stoyle, Research Professor of Middle East Security at the U.S. Army Strategic Studies Institute and Chair of Applied History at the Modern War Institute. He previously served at the U.S. Army School of Advanced Military Studies and co-founded the International Working Group on Subterranean Warfare. Dr. Stoyle holds a doctorate from Oxford and has spent over a decade researching the Israeli military and regional security dynamics. His work focuses on applying historical lessons to contemporary operational problems, including multinational stabilization forces and irregular warfare in the Middle East. Before we begin, I just want to make a note that Dr. Stoyle is joining us in his personal capacity. The views, analysis, and opinions he expresses this evening are his own and do not necessarily affect those of the United States Army, the U.S. government, or any other official body. So after the ad break, I'm going to welcome Jacob.
High FM, your station of choice since 2008.
You are listening to The War Room on 101.9 High FM with David Katz, and I'm joined by Dr. Jacob Stoyle. Welcome, Jacob. Welcome to High FM.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for having me. And David, let me say that I think this is a great new initiative that you and High FM have to really bring discussions of contemporary strategy, warfare, the security environment with a good military history background to your listeners. So congratulations on setting this up, and to everyone listening who's observing, I hope you all are having an easy fast and looking forward to a very good forum and a Chag Sameach tonight.
No, thank you for that. And yes, I think it is a good initiative because we're living in quite strange times, and the military aspects need to be unpacked. So this is going to give us a platform, Jacob, for people like you and me to come on and get involved in some of the complexities of modern warfare as it is. So I'm so glad that you've joined us, and I hope that this is not going to be the last time that we, going forward, you can be a regular guest. We've heard a lot today in the last couple of days about Iran. It's overtaken events. And as I said, I really do want to discuss Gaza with you tonight because I think that's fundamental. But we're not going to get away with it without having a look at some of the events that are happening at Iran in the moment. So let's get your take on it. What's happening there? What's happening in Iran? What are the implications? What's the deal?
That's a very good question and a very good way to start out. I think we need to start out with looking at a little bit of history. Iran has effectively been at war with the United States for more than 40 years, right? Iran has, and its proxies started attacking the U.S. and our personnel and our civilians and our citizens in the early 1980s. In fact, they started by taking our people hostage, right? That was right at the beginning of the revolution. And they've been pretty open about their intent towards the United States and their intent, obviously, towards Israel ever since. And there's been a steady drumbeat of things they've done, whether it's potentially the Khobar Towers bombing, whether it's definitely the Beirut embassy bombing, whether it's the orchestrating the murder of the American rector or senior faculty member at American University in Beirut in the 1980s, to supplying any countless number of terror groups who have attacked U.S. soldiers and U.S. personnel. So to an extent, what we're seeing now is a country that's been at war with the United States, and the United States is kind of getting around to being at war with it after about 40 years. But when we think about the precipitating incidents here, I think you have to really look back towards the summer when the U.S. took a limited role in Operation, what was the U.S. termed Operation Midnight Hammer, which was the U.S. component of the strikes to degrade Iran's nuclear program this summer. And part of the limited approach here was it gave Iran an off-ramp. It gave Iran a chance to change its trajectory and change its behavior. And the U.S. really had three central demands with this, which is stop developing long-range offensive missile systems, stop developing and pushing for nuclear weapons, and stop really funding this global proxy war against the U.S. and our allies and partners. At that point, Iran really had two ways it could have looked at the world coming out of Midnight Hammer. It could have looked at it and said, all right, the U.S. is very powerful, and they chose to give us an off-ramp, right? They chose to extend mercy and give us a way to reform and not have further war. Or, and unfortunately for the Iranian regime and for, you know, in any war, the civilians and soldiers who are going to get killed.
Yes.
Unfortunately, the Iranian regime took a different narrative approach, which was, look, our strategy worked. We were able to force the U.S. into a limited strike. They really didn't want to do regime change here. They didn't want to do a big strike. And so we're going to continue to pursue the direction we were because we think it's working. That reinforced their kind of way of dealing with the U.S. and the globe as you got to the protests this winter, and we can get more deeply into those if you wish, as they massacred their own people in the streets, thousands of their own people.
Yes, shocking.
And the U.S. said, hey, you have to stop doing that. They didn't stop doing it. And now we hit another point of nuclear negotiations where it really came time for Iran to have one last option to change its course, and it didn't. And so that brings us to a point where eventually militarily, once you align a certain amount of capability against a problem, there's a window of time where you can either have the decision to use that capability or not. And so Iran knew it was entering that window of time and chose not to change course. And that really got us to where we are today. In answer to what's going on, I think in your opening, you highlighted it very, very well, that what we're seeing is something unprecedented, which is deep U.S.-Israeli coordination on large-scale operations. And for those of your listeners who don't understand or don't know the U.S. military terribly well, there are lots of people who say, oh, the Russian military is bigger, or the Chinese military is bigger, or things like this. But what the U.S. military has in an unparalleled capacity is what's called global strike and global reach. The U.S. military, and I think this is something that Iran possibly had trouble conceiving, has the ability, because of all of its sustainment capabilities, all of its logistics capabilities, to move around the entire globe at relatively short notice and bring truly phenomenal amounts of combat power and generate a historically unprecedented amount of combat power anywhere in the world with a relatively short window of time. And we're really seeing the effect of that here. That in a matter of weeks, the U.S. military was able to build up in the region and is even flying strike missions of some of our assets from the United States all the way to Iran and back out of Iran's reach. And so I think Iran just didn't understand truly the capability that is. And it's a mistake lots of countries have made before.
Absolutely. I think there's no doubt, and certainly in my mind, that the USA is able to project power way beyond its borders. I mean, it does have that capability, and we're witnessing that right now. What's the end game here, Jacob? You know, are we looking at regime change? Are we looking at something less? What is the actual end game?
So I think there are really two directions that the end game could go. And to an extent, the ball's in the court is partially in Iran's court. The president of the United States has been very clear that if Iran were willing to come to the table and agree to no nuclear weapons, agree to stop massacring its people in the streets, and agree to end its long-range missile program and its support for terror, there would be room for a negotiation, right? There would be room for something else to occur here. And if not, the U.S. retains the capability to pursue regime change. And so it's really hit a moment of decision for Iran of what version of reality do they want? Do they want to give up these kind of aggressive and highly repressive activities? In which case, there may be a way forward for them where the state's more limited. Or are they really prepared to fight their way down with the ship? In which case, it will end up being a pursuit of regime change.
I'm going to just repeat something that Hegseth said this afternoon. I believe it was this afternoon. He said that the Iranians have used the conventional umbrella to pursue nuclear ambitions. So it seems to me that, I mean, short of regime change here, the USA and Israel are interested in removing or degrading substantially that conventional umbrella so as to make vulnerable any moves towards nuclear ambitions. So he has expressed that there's something less than regime change going on here. I know everybody is a lot of people, not everybody, a lot of people are hoping for regime change, but I would say there are more limited objectives here. And we can take a leaf out of Hegseth's book in saying what it is. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think there is certainly the option for more limited objectives, right? This doesn't have to go to regime change. There's definitely the option available for more limited objectives. But again, it would require what we're seeing already, which is a significant degrading of Iranian military power. And I know some of the news that's kind of coming out about, oh, which targets were hit, which buildings were destroyed, is very hard to parse, right? Because you have to understand the significance of each building. Every time, you know, a satellite image shows up, what does that building mean? But if you take it together, what you're seeing is the leadership and senior echelons and the command and control of Iran's strike capability, its ability to reach beyond its own borders, was vastly degraded. Its missile capabilities, its air defense capabilities, its naval capabilities have already been vastly degraded.
Great, Jacob. We're going to take an ad break now, and when we come back, we will discuss what are some of the successes that have been achieved in this operation.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Let's just have a look quickly what successes have been achieved. What targets appear to have been struck? And where does it go from here? Is there a time limit on this?
So the successes that have been achieved are really profound so far. Obviously, as has been in the news a lot, most of the senior leadership of the Iranian kind of military repressive state has been completely eliminated, whether that's the supreme leader, the head of the IRGC, lots of the senior figures. In addition to that, many of the headquarters that they rely upon for projecting power beyond their borders and also for repressing their own people, especially in Tehran, have been eliminated, especially in the last 24 hours. In addition to that, their capabilities, the things that they advertise as truly powerful, whether it's their drones, whether it's their rocket array, whether it's their air defenses, are being degraded at an incredibly rapid rate. And this has moved beyond such things lower down into their actual combat formations, again, that are heavily used to murder and repress their own population. Their internal intelligence headquarters have been eliminated. All of these very, very key targets. As this moves forward, if this is going to pursue to regime change, what you'll see is a further degradation, further elimination of those things that they rely upon and those formations that they rely upon to oppress their own people. And so as those start being cut, think of it as a little bit of like cutting shackles, you'll see the population starting to having the potential to start to shake free a little bit more. And in addition to that, we really have to talk about the background that gets us here, because before this even happened, as a result of the October 7th war, one of Iran's most powerful assets, its proxy network, Hamas and Hezbollah, was already significantly degraded. And so before we even get to this, Iran is not what Iran once was. After the Operation Rising Lion this summer, was even further degraded. And so that really opened a vulnerability that's allowing for this truly significant success,
Jacob,
at least so far.
Jacob, tell me, is there not a bit of a credibility gap here? Just help me get through this, that Donald Trump has said he is willing to negotiate. What can the Iranian problem, if there's going to be some type of a move towards a regime change, what do the Iranian people at the grassroots level think about this? Is there a credibility gap over here? I mean, do they come out, if Donald Trump is now prepared to enter into negotiations with the current regime, what incentive is there for the Iranian people to come out and try and effect regime change, knowing what happened to them previously? I mean, with reported over 30,000 casualties. I mean, an absolute massacre in the streets. Is this not a mixed message that's being sent out?
I can't really speak to the messaging that has been sent out so far by the United States, but what I can speak to is that we've already seen some spontaneous demonstrations by the Iranian people, celebrations in the street with the death of the Supreme Leader. We've seen a weakening of the security forces. And I think really as this goes on, that will be more of the trigger. If you see those security forces getting further and further weakened, that will be more of the trigger to the Iranian people. You're right. To an extent right now, the Iranian people seem to be in something of a wait and see mode. And you absolutely, after coming from such a massacre, and there's a long history of this, right, of people believing that a potential military operation is ready to set them free and rising up and it not happening. I mean, the classic example, of course, is the uprising in Budapest in 1956,
yes,
which was crushed by the Soviets, right? So we absolutely don't want that to happen. But the regime is certainly weakening. The regime's ability to repress its population is certainly weakening. And the longer this goes on, the harder it will be for the regime to keep itself intact. I think the way to think about this is really a question of frequency and duration. The regime is built to withstand a high frequency attack, kind of attack we're seeing, over a limited duration. As the duration increases, the regime's ability to repress its own population and stay in power decreases. And what you'll see, as you saw in the previous Iranian revolution that brought in the regime, is you'll start to see a testing of its boundaries, of the population seeing what they can do, seeing how far they can push. And if there's too big a crack in the regime security, that will obviously lead to regime change. And I think I can speak for most people who don't want massacres in this world and would like a kind of hated regime removed. But I really hope, whether it's the U.S. that brings that about, whether it's Israel that brings it about, or whether the Iranian people find the crack, I hope that we are seeing the last days of the Islamic Republic. But I do think you're right. There are certainly this possibility of an off-ramp of regime, but it would have to be a very different regime to be able to take that limited possibility. It would have to be one that is not going to pursue its kind of aggressive, expansionist military agenda, that will not continue to pursue war against the United States and Israel. And I think such a regime may also have a very different flavor towards its own population, though not necessarily.
Jacob, I think you'll agree with me that the one thing that is off the table is massive boots on the ground. That's just not going to happen. The old style of doing things like in Iraq and Afghanistan, that's not an option anymore.
I'll never say never. However, I think you can see, and it's been in the news, there aren't huge U.S. soldier boots sitting on the ground ready to come in, you know, ready to surge across the border. We don't have the buildup that we saw in the second Gulf War or the first Gulf War, or even for that matter, Bosnia, right? We don't have that kind of force build up there and waiting. And we've said that we're not particularly interested in that, that the days of the forever wars are behind us and the days of U.S. occupations in the Middle East are behind us. But I would point to the fact that the U.S. does have global lift and global reach capability. And so if that became a absolutely necessary primary option. We do have the capability to do it. It's just not something strategically I think we're particularly interested in at this juncture. But I wouldn't want to really comment on what might be U.S. policy or might not be U.S. policy, right? The option, as long as the capability exists, the option is always on the table, even if there are lots of signs that that's not necessarily the way we're headed.
Good. As good historians, can we put ourselves in the shoes now of the Iranians, as difficult as that is, but it's a good exercise? And what is their game plan? What is their best hope? What can they hold out for? I know you're saying their best hope now is negotiations, but I mean, if these people are not prepared to bend, what is their strategy? I mean, we can see them flinging missiles all over the Gulf. There must be a strategy of thinking behind that. What's their game plan?
Yeah, we're actually seeing their game plan right now, which is, and that's flinging missiles and drones all over the Gulf, and actually recently even targeting Cyprus, and both Cyprus and now potentially some UK facilities there. Their strategy is to internationalize this conflict as much as possible, right? Again, I will go back to the point that they can survive very high frequency as long as it's short duration. So what they're going to try to do is make as much pain for as much people as possible to get those countries to essentially call up to the United States and say, all right, please end this. Right, please end this conflict. It's too much, too painful. We didn't want to be part of it to begin with. You've done a lot of good already. Just take an off-ramp. Find a negotiated off-ramp. Find a negotiated solution. So their goal is to inflict as much pain on as much countries as possible. It's why you're seeing blatant disregard for the laws of war. So, for instance, they directly targeted the Palm Hotel with a fairly precision strike drone in Dubai. Right, there is no law of war that says a civilian hotel that's purely operating as a civilian hotel is ever a legitimate target for direct targeting in Iran, obviously, when it did this.
Incredible.
It's not the only civilian structure they've targeted. They're targeting fairly indiscriminately in Israel. They've targeted civilian structures elsewhere in the UAE, in Bahrain, in Qatar. They targeted also in Saudi. And the real goal here is to have all of these countries say, you know what, U.S., you've done enough. Please stop now. And so really their strategy is to acknowledge and accept that the next few days are going to be very, very painful. But as long as it ends in the next few days, the regime can survive. And if it survives, it can rebuild. And it's really, and this might be a good segue to think about in terms of Gaza or Lebanon, it's really what their proxies are trying to pursue as well, right? Hamas agreed to a 20-point ceasefire plan that in essence would cease Hamas's ability to fulfill its core mission as a militant group. And their goal now is to outlast it, right? To go wait for the implementation phase and make that very, very difficult. And you can see a similar strategy with Iran. They need to get enough pain to enough countries, enough of the world involved, that they start putting pressure on the U.S. to end it. And if the U.S. ends it, then what Iran will hope is that even if they preliminarily agree to give up certain things, then in the long run, they won't really have to, or they'll have a way to redevelop back.
Okay, so there's definitely a method in the madness in what they're doing.
Absolutely. I know it can become very easy to look at Iran and see maybe they're religious fanatics, maybe, you know, I've heard some people say, oh, they're Shia death cult, things like that. They may have some of those religious beliefs, but they are still smart strategic actors. You don't sail around as long as they have as a power in the Middle East without being a smart strategic actor. So there is absolutely a method.
No, absolutely. I do agree with you. I think, did you mention Oman? Incredibly, Oman was one of those also targeted. I mean, that is the center of the negotiations. And I mean, they're busy receiving missiles. I was thinking that maybe because of the decapitation, that some of this decision-making has sunk down to the tactical levels, and some of the decision-making of sending these missiles over, we're not done at the highest levels. I mean, I was just thinking that could also be a possibility. But I think I'll go with you. This is done at the strategic level, and certainly it's playing for time. And I think some of the pressure might be coming through on the USA and the Israel to as you say, take an off-ramp. I think we're starting to see a little bit of that.
Yeah, and I think the more countries that get drawn in, the more that pressure will increase, because there are a lot of countries who really don't want to be involved. And I'll go back to the UK is now finding itself having to be involved when it really didn't want to. It really wanted to stay out of it.
Yes.
And it's now being involved in defensive air operations and potentially even just defensive strike operations, right? This was not a place they wanted to be. This is their focus is on Europe, on the Russian threat from Ukraine and some other things. And so they really don't want to be involved in this. And now they find themselves having to be involved. And because of that, it won't be there. We can see there's going to be this kind of global pressure. Now, what Iran risks is the opposite, is that all of these countries go, you know what, this really is a dangerous regime. Look what they're doing. Actually, it's time for regime change, right? We can't have this in our neighborhood anymore. So there is a distinct risk in Iran's strategy that countries like UAE, like Oman, like Qatar, like Saudi, who are more willing to sit on the fence and sit in a neutral position, and Britain, again, who was not taking part in this, are now coming on board and saying, actually, maybe this is it. Maybe we really can't have a neighbor like Iran. So there's a risk in their strategy, but it's possibly their only strategy forward if they don't want to capitulate on the negotiation.
I think Pete Hegseth had a quite a rugged observation to make today in his speech when he turned around and said, you know, these Israelis, I paraphrase him, but he says, you know, these Israelis put their money where their mouth is. No, these are allies that we can rely on. Unlike others that have been traditional allies for a long time. He actually said that in his speech. That was incredible to hear. The next thing I want to do, I think we've ventilated that pretty well, Jacob. There's been a lot said about this. This has been occupying the airwaves, and rightly so. But I want to pivot over to something very, very important, which is also your area of expertise. And I think this is the crux of the matter for Israel, is Gaza. And where to now over Gaza? Because I believe that's where the war will eventually be won or lost. Do you agree with that observation?
So I think the important thing to understand here in Gaza is that we have a couple of different possibilities, right? Hamas has insulated itself somewhat for the loss of Iranian support. It has support from Qatar. It has support from Turkey. And what I think you really have to look at here is that whatever happens with Iran, Gaza will continue to be an issue that needs a separate resolution. On the other hand, resolving Gaza will not resolve Iran. So they are two distinct areas with distinct solutions, but really common linkages is the best way to think of it.
Okay, Jacob, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick ad break, and when we are back, we will continue the conversation.
IFM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
You're listening to The War Room on 101.9 Chai FM with David Katz, and I'm talking to Dr. Jacob Stoyle. Jacob, let's carry on a little bit about Gaza here, and give me a brief overview of what the position in Gaza looked like before the latest USA Israeli strikes on Iran. And I want to do the before, because the next thing I'm going to ask you is, has the current scenario changed anything in that perspective?
So before the current strike, the Israeli military sits on something called the Yellow Line, which is a line that separates the Gaza Strip into two effective areas. You have an area that's slightly over 50% of the territory, which is under Israeli military control behind the Yellow Line. And by behind, I mean east, south, and north. But principally, we can talk about it as east of the Yellow Line. And then you have an area of about 50%, a little bit under, that is under Hamas control, that's contained within the Yellow Line, that's west of it. And in the area under Hamas control, Hamas is absolutely reasserting authority. They are executing their enemies. They are enforcing law. They are doing all of the kind of bad things they were doing before. They are taking humanitarian aid. They are taxing. They are building up military capability. They're trying to reconstitute. And they're also taking military commanders and transitioning them into civilian positions as mayors and governors and things like that. And we can talk about, if you're interested, that part of the strategy, because it is very interesting. It was just announced that there are going to be countries who are going to contribute to an international security force that will enter Gaza to begin to allow for peaceful reconstruction of some parts of Gaza, assumedly in the areas currently under Israeli military occupation. These are not, the force doesn't look like it's going to be capable of going and confronting Hamas in the red zone in the area Hamas controls. So it will be beginning in the areas under Israeli security control. And it will be working with the smaller number of Palestinians who are there. We also have something called the NCAG, the NCAG, which is a government-like body of a, what's called the technocratic government that's been agreed to by the Board of Peace to begin governing Gaza. It hasn't entered Gaza yet. It's waiting for a change in the security environment for the International Security Force to get on the ground, which should be happening, well, pre-war, was supposed to be happening relatively soon. And then the last thing is we're seeing the training of a vetted Palestinian security force. These are people who the Israelis, as well as the international community, have agreed are not members of Hamas, are not part of a terror infrastructure, and who can be trusted to start to be a Palestinian security force that eventually will be able to take over security and potentially even confront Hamas. So that's kind of the situation. A lot of promise, a lot of things that are getting ready to happen. But if you ask what is the situation actually on the ground, you have Hamas controlling slightly under 50% of the Gaza Strip, looking up back to its old ways, and you have Israel controlling, with the help of some local militias and other folks, about a little bit over 50% of the Strip, and you have the majority of the population in Gaza living in that Hamas-controlled area. And then a lot of promise that good things will happen in the future.
Do you think that this international security force has will really have the appetite now to go into this heavily populated area now, steadily being recontrolled by Hamas, and go in there and have the appetite to disarm Hamas, demilitarize them, and gain control of the civilian population? It all seems to me, it seems a bit pie in the sky.
It's not just a question of appetite, it's also a question of capability, right? To go into Hamas's stronghold, as the Israelis know all too well, is not an easy task, especially in dense urban terrain.
No.
Especially since Hamas, and your listeners might not be familiar with this, there are areas of the Gaza Strip that Israel never touched in its ground operations. It never went there. The so-called humanitarian zone, among others. And that Hamas's infrastructure is largely intact there, right? It's an area that stayed under Hamas control through the entire. And that would require significant combat capability to do. So I don't think it's realistic at this juncture, unless something changes, to think about an international security force going directly, taking this direct approach and going aggressively into the Hamas-controlled area, forcibly disarming Hamas, demilitarizing its subterranean infrastructure, and then liberating the population and being able to kind of rebuild it. I think it's not, at this juncture, realistic. That doesn't mean there's not a way forward. And I recently published an article with the Mitzvim Institute in Israel. It's available online for anyone who wants to look at it, looking at an alternative way, taking facts on the ground as they are. And this would be to take something of an indirect approach, essentially building and reconstructing Gaza in the Israeli secured zone first, having the ISF, the International Security Force, get on the ground, start to provide security where it's capable of, build its capability, build its experience, and then invite Gazan population to transition through a vetted process from one to the other, to go from Hamas control, to leave Hamas control, and go into the newly reconstructed area that the International Security Force is securing behind the yellow line, in east of the yellow line. And the importance of this is for Hamas to continue to thrive and fight, it relies on a lot of taxation of population and a lot of humanitarian aid. As the population shifts, so too will the bulk of that, and that can weaken Hamas to the point that it's no longer the Hamas we know and hate, but a Hamas that's much easier for a Palestinian security force or an international security force to take care of. Now, there are a lot of risks to this process. It won't happen quickly. It could stall at any time. It requires international will for the duration, right? So this is not an easy process. But I think it is a realistic process, as opposed to kind of, as you say, the pie in the sky idea that the International Security Force will come on the ground, and as soon as it does, it will roll into the Hamas areas and eliminate the threat. I just don't think, at this juncture, unless something changes, that that's terribly realistic.
So Jacob, I want to understand this. You are saying that at present there is no real doctrine for this international security force to come in. I mean, what you're saying to me is that nothing has really been decided on how they're going to operate and what they're going to do. You've put something on the table, which is taking a sort of indirect approach, and we're going to examine that now. But I need to understand this. So this international security force has no doctrine at this stage of the game.
I can't really speak about whether it has doctrine or not. That's a level beyond which I can speak about. What I can speak about is when you're putting together a multinational peacekeeping force, it's no surprise that there are national caveats, right? It's always by volunteer. Countries have to be willing to accept certain missions. And the countries who are looking at taking part in this international security force seem, at least from their statements, not to be super willing to go in and actually directly confront Hamas in a high-tempo military context. They also don't seem to have the capabilities. They're bringing the capabilities to do that. Now, I'm not going to say, could this change in tomorrow? You know, they're going to come with this. There's still negotiations, etc. And I'm not going to say there's no doctrine or plan for how to do this. But what I will say is, on the surface, looking at it, there does not seem to be a feasible way for the International Security Force or Stabilization Force, as it is currently looking and as it's currently developing, to go militarily in to disband Hamas, to disarm Hamas in Hamas's stronghold. I don't see that as terribly realistic. Again, I'm not saying it couldn't happen, and I'm not saying that couldn't change, but it does not seem terribly realistic at this juncture.
But this is what's called for. I mean, it's a peace enforcement operation as opposed to a peace operation. It's a peace enforcement. It's going to take an international stability force to go in there and actually enforce the peace. And that's what that goes back to appetite. But I'm quite interested. Okay, so let's drill a little bit deeper into the indirect approach, the solution that you spoke about. Give me a little bit more detail about this, as opposed to just now deploying an international security force on the ground that's going to go in and try and enforce a peace. Give me a little bit about what your doctrine involves.
Yeah, so my proposal is a phased approach, and it allows at any point, should there be international capability and will, for a transition to a direct approach, right, to actually going in and kind of forcibly disarming. But should that not occur, it gives a way forward for how the International Security Force and the NCAG in Israel can work together to really change the situation for the better and degrade Hamas to the point where Hamas is vulnerable. And so what it looks like is a phased approach. In the initial phase, the Israeli military will stay on the yellow line, i.e. will stay in this barrier position, encapsulating Hamas-controlled area and preventing Hamas from getting out and from attacking elsewhere. The Israeli force will stay there. In the first phase, the International Security Force should take over the security for an area between the yellow line, i.e. between the Israeli force and the Israeli border, and should start operating in a security manner there to really build their capability, to get used to working together as a team. Anyone who's ever played team sports understands that the first time you meet your colleagues should never be on the pitch, right? You don't want to meet them for the first time there and try to figure out how to coordinate anything. Not a great idea. So give it a train up, essentially, where it's taking over security responsibility. It's clearing unexploded ordnance. It's working on demolition of underground military capabilities of some of those Hamas tunnels. And it's taking over security and running security in an area, but with the Israelis as a buffer zone between it and kind of the main force of Hamas. Once this area is cleared, it enters, in my mind, a second phase where it can begin reconstruction tasks. So rebuilding housing, rebuilding economy, etc. And in this phase is a great phase for the NCAG itself to start building legitimacy and building its authority by taking over and running and showing to both the Palestinian population, the Israeli population, and the globe that it's capable of doing this redevelopment, right? Bringing in this redevelopment through the NCAG in the area that the ISF has succeeded. This will also involve some amount of Palestinian population transitioning from the red area, from Hamas control, into the now ISF secured, a vetted percentage of the population. And so you'd show that the NCAG can govern, etc. Now, this then gets replicated throughout the area, the Israeli secured area, so the Israel stays on the O-line. ISF grows, takes more responsibility, builds more reconstruction, and slowly, slowly at first, and then faster and faster, more population is allowed and encouraged to leave the Hamas-controlled areas into these kind of reconstructed areas under the NCAG and under the ISF, with also the training of a vetted Palestinian security force happening. As this expands and as more population is leaving Hamas-controlled area, and obviously, again, I want to emphasize vetted, there has to be a vetting process for this, the Hamas will get weaker and weaker. And as Hamas weakens, the ISF gets comparatively stronger, the Palestinian security force is getting stronger. Eventually, there will hit a turning point where Hamas is not the Hamas that they once were, right? Where Hamas has been weakened so significantly, it no longer requires major military operations to start to disarm. They can be disarmed by sections, they can be disarmed in areas, right? And the ISF can start to transition from securing behind the yellow line to securing on the yellow line. And so this is not a time approach. This is not, hey, this will take a year, this will take 6 months, each phase is 6 months. No, this is a conditions-based approach. So each phase has to be determined by the success of the previous phase.
We're going to continue the discussion after the break.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
You are listening to The War Room on 101.9 Chai FM with David Katz, and I'm in conversation with Dr. Jacob Stoyle. Jacob, give me a feel, just very briefly and quickly, what is the makeup of this international security force? I want to get a feel for the participants to see if they've got appetite.
So right now, some of the participants, and I can't list them all, but some of the participants are countries like Indonesia and Kosovo and Albania, among others.
Okay, so it's going to be quite a toss. So Israel's got a big role to play in that also, in the training and turning this into some type of a combined armed operation.
So
that's going to work.
It probably won't be Israel doing the training. And this is actually a really important part of when we talk about the role of an international security force. The international security force has to have legitimacy, both with the Palestinian population and with the Israeli population and with the international community. It's actually fairly hard road to hoe. And this is really important because if it's seen too close to the Israelis, and of course it's going to have to coordinate with them, then it will not have legitimacy among the Palestinian population. So there's a limit to how much the Israelis can be involved in, at least openly, training an international security force. Now, it's got a U.S. commander, General Jeffers, who is formerly with Special Operations Command, the Special Operations aspect of Central Command. So it's got this U.S. commander to help legitimately. There's obviously going to be international training and security resources behind it, but there will be a learning period, a train-up period, of course, as there would for any deployment of any military, whether it's a coalition or an individual country deploying.
Jacob convinced me. I need convincing. I'm old enough to remember the Protective Hamlet program in Vietnam. Why is this going to be any different? I mean, this is, you're basically proposing that, are you not?
No, I think the key difference is the time and duration here, right? I don't think this is a free amnesty for everyone, right? But there does need to be, if there's going to be a way forward, some form of what in the U.S. is called a DDR process, a disarmament, demilitarization, and reintegration process in Gaza. And the exact shape of that has yet to be determined. But there does have to be a way for people who are Gazans, who are living under Hamas, who may not have been bought into Hamas or Islamic Jihad, to declare so and to come out and forward. And we see such a process at the end of World War II in both East and West Germany, right, where there was the denazification process. But the critical thing is it will to keep it up, right? What often happens is you get either a blanket amnesty, hey, everybody come in from the cold, which is means that all of the really bad actors get a fresh start, and that's not great. Or you see a temporary DDR, okay, we're going to start it, but we're not going to keep it up. We're not going to keep vetting people. We're not going to keep the security footprint that's necessary over the long term. And to me, these are risks, right? There is certainly the risk of failure on this, and I'm not going to tell you that there's not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? Because there is absolutely the risk of failure.
Yes.
There's a risk of a loss of international commitment. There's a risk of a lack of international capability. There are 1.5 million risks to this working. Would I prefer a direct approach? If you ask me, I'm on record, I'm published on it, that I would prefer a direct approach, that I would prefer a very robust security force. Yes. That can move immediately into the red zone, take over, disarm Hamas, demilitarize the Strip. Unfortunately, the business of strategy is the business of reality.
Yes.
And the business, the reality is these are the countries who are contributing. This is the shape of the force. And so there is still a path forward. But I'm not going to convince you it's not without significant risk, because it's with significant risk. But it is a path forward.
Well, let's circle back for the last question. Let's circle back to the current situation now in Iran. I would just think off the top of my head that this should improve the situation in Gaza, should improve the prospects of this international security force. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, I think in two key ways it does, right? Hamas received a lot of its military capability from Iran, a lot of its military training. Iran was an incredibly important factor for it. And in addition to that, with Iran at the center, it was part of a nexus of the proxy organizations, whether it's the Houthis, whether it's Hezbollah, whether it's Qasib Hezbollah in Iraq, right? There's this network of proxy organizations that can all work towards the same goal, all coordinated by Iran. Removing this, should that be fully removed, then that would greatly degrade that capability. In addition, Iran has been behind some of the more effective information operations, some of the propaganda that has been hurting Israel and hurting the chance for the ISF to succeed. Removing that key capability will obviously be important. But I don't want to oversell. I don't want to say that removing Iran suddenly makes Gaza rainbows and unicorns and, you know, puppy dogs and happiness.
Of course not.
Right? Hamas isn't solely backed by Iran. In this way, they're different from Hezbollah. Hamas has support from Turkey and it has support from Qatar. And together, this gives them the ability to have a little bit more longevity than some of the other Iranian proxies. So it's definitely helpful. And more to the point, it's helpful for the entire region to remove this very, very dangerous regime and to degrade it. And it's helpful for the long-term cause of peace and for the credibility of actors like Israel and the United States. I'll go back to the point that I made at the beginning. Iran has been fighting a 40-year war with the United States, and the United States is now fighting back.
Jacob, I want to thank you for such a thoughtful and measured analysis this evening. I think what we've done tonight is a move beyond headlines and into the harder strategic questions. So I thank you for that. Your indirect approach reminds us that military victory alone doesn't resolve political conflict. Stabilization requires patience, as you've pointed out, legitimacy and sustained coordination. And even then, as you've pointed out, the risks are going to be significant. Again, thank you for your insights and for joining us, and thank you to the listeners for joining us at the War Room. Good night, everybody.